Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased that we have with us a man who has been for quite some time at the forefront of that fight in the war for the free world on Capitol Hill. He is Peter Roskam. He represents with great distinction the people of the 6th District of Illinois. He serves on the, as always described, Influential Ways and Means Committee. In fact, he's the chairman of its oversight subcommittee. He is also a member of the House Select Committee on Benghazi. And Congressman, I want to welcome you back. You've just returned from Davos, Switzerland, so I know you've got international affairs very much on your mind. Good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you today. I really appreciate you having me on.
It's always a pleasure. Speaking of international affairs, one of them that is playing out rather dramatically at the moment is this contretemps over the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, being invited by the Speaker of the House to address a joint session of Congress in the near future. You are the co-chairman of the House Israel Caucus, and I wonder what you make both of the advisability of that invitation and the president's response to it.
I think the advisability is high. I think the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, was wise to invite Prime Minister Netanyahu. I think it gives him a forum and it communicates that he is warmly regarded and that the administration's Iranian policy is not highly regarded on Capitol Hill. I'm disappointed that President Obama, the administration up until now at least, has said that they won't meet with the Prime Minister, even though he's going to be in Washington, and they're claiming that it's imminent with elections in Israel. But I think we can look back at past history where other Israeli prime ministers met with American presidents within a month of an election. I think it's a lost opportunity for President Obama, but I do think it's a good thing that the Speaker has invited the Prime Minister to Washington.
You've hit on two points that we're going to follow up on. One is a question, of course, of the difficult relationship between President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu, and more generally, I think the attitude the president has towards Bibi's country, which is, it seems, very, very much to be, well, hostile, I think is the right word for it. Talk a little bit about that relationship and how important it is, in your view, to our security interests, not just to Israel's.
I think we've got one incredibly close friend in the Middle East, and that is Israel, who is under, as you know, just incredible pressure right now. And the Obama administration, with the overtures and now the sanctions deal that they're pushing, it's a bad plan. It's a bad policy. It has a negative impact on Israel, but it has a negative impact in the on the United States. So Israeli foreign policy in this case lines up closely with American foreign policy. And look, if Israel has a strong sense of confidence in its relationship with the American administration, it gives it more flexibility in the Middle East. And if they feel ambiguous or they feel like they're not going to get backed up, then it very much influences what their capacity is in terms of negotiating. So I think the administration now is really seeking a foreign policy legacy, and it's not a good one, in my view.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Congressman, you know, the president is saying that he doesn't want to interfere in the election by hosting Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Do you think that he might be interfering in the election by essentially indicating a certain, well, dissidence, shall we say?
I think that's a great point, and it's a fair argument. The notion that the Prime Minister of Israel comes to the United States at the invitation and gives a speech to a joint session of Congress, arguably one of the biggest forums for a foreign leader, for a world leader in the entire world, and not able to meet with the President of the United States when they're going to be within a mile of one another. You know, to your point, I think that is playing politics in Israel, and it's not an appropriate response by President Obama.
And it's not the first time, of course, that a president of the United States has tried to defeat Benjamin Netanyahu. In fact, Bill Clinton did it back in the 90s. Let me turn to more directly the issue that you've touched on several times. And again, our guest is Peter Roskam. He is the chairman of the Oversight Committee of the House Ways and Means Committee and represents the people of the 6th District of Illinois. Iran is kind of the theme that we expect Benjamin Netanyahu to focus upon. You, of course, have been one of the leaders in the Congress, Representative Roskam, that has argued the president's policy, as you've just said, is not working. The negotiations are not producing results that are in our interest and will conduce to an Iranian bomb. What should we be doing now? Specifically, what do you think the Congress should be doing now under these circumstances?
The Congress should move the Kirk Menendez language and similar language in the House of Representatives. You know, in the last Congress, this bill in the United States Senate, remember, this would have been under Harry Reid leadership, under the United States Senate, it had 57 co-sponsors, bipartisan co-sponsors, which basically gets the sanctions back on and begins to move very, very quickly. I am confident that we'd be able to pass that in the House of Representatives and put that on the president's desk. Now, the irony is, in a speech where he claims to be bipartisan, the president laid out a veto threat saying that if that gets on his desk, he will veto it. And I think the false premise, Frank, of the Obama administration's approach on Iran is that they have accepted a premise that there is such a thing as a peaceful nuclear ambition for Iran. There is no such thing. It does not exist. It is a pipe dream. The Iranians do not want nuclear capabilities just, for science and so forth. This is an incredibly aggressive regime, and they're going to use it to a bad end, and we ought not be complicit in it. And history is very, very clear that when we are deceived by tyrants, they take advantage of it. They take advantage of it from a timing point of view, and we ought to recognize that.
Well, I'm so glad you said that with such clarity, Congressman Roskam, because it seems to me that the president is, in fact, now clearing the way for the Iranian bomb. And the bipartisanship, I guess, if there is any, is that he's sort of spitting in the face of people on both sides of the aisle as he proceeds to insist that that there be more time to allow them to beaver away at getting their nuclear ambitions fulfilled. Can I just ask about this, on your point about the dangers of this regime? I'm very appreciative to you and your team for helping us put together a program on Wednesday in the Capitol on this very subject, the true nature of this Iranian regime and why they can't be trusted, let alone allowed to acquire this worst of all weapons. Congressman Roskam, though, is it enough, do you think, as I understand the Kirk Menendez bill, to impose sanctions if at the end of the current deadline there will be no agreement? And even then, the president is given a waiver. Is that really a strong enough piece of legislation in your mind for in light of the kind of circumstances we're facing at the moment?
Well, I think what you're describing is a complete redo. You know what I mean? To your point, you don't want to be in this situation at all, and you'd be, you'd really have a higher preference to have more options. I think the realistic approach is if we were able to get the Kirk Menendez language out of the Senate and on the president's desk, it would shift the momentum entirely. It would signal to the rest of the world that the sanctions regime are going to be put back into place. It would tighten things up, because right now with the loosening of sanctions, remember, it's all cumulative, as you know. You begin to loosen here, you begin to loosen there. All of a sudden, you've got companies that are positioning themselves to be the first ones into the Iranian market that they perceive to be opening. And you've had some success over the years with help, having other nations around the world diminish their importing of Iranian energy and so forth. So there's a lot to be done. So in answer to your question, yeah, is Kirk Menendez perfect? Clearly not. But it is the most realistic, momentum-shifting piece of legislation that's available to us.
And I think you're absolutely right. There's no question it will drive the Iranians crazy. And presumably that's part of why the administration is so determined to oppose it. I hope you're right, Congressman Ruscom, that we will see it on the president's desk in the near future. At the very least, this is what's needed, and more would be desirable, as we'll talk about on Wednesday. Hopefully with you, sir. Thank you so much for giving us a chance to talk with you today and for the work you do in the Congress of the United States. As I say, representing with great distinction the people of the 6th District of Illinois. And all of us, and your leadership on Israel and Iran and so much more. We appreciate you taking the time to visit with us. Hope you'll do so again.
Thanks, Frank.
Next up, Joe Kuehmeier joins us to talk about the Nussmann assassination, Iran, and more in our hemisphere. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by a man who knows his stuff about the Western Hemisphere, and we consult with regularity because his insights into what is happening there and what may be about to happen there are without parallel. He is Joseph Heumeier. He is the author, among other things, of Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, and he is a veteran of the United States Marine Corps, having served in combat in Iraq and Liberia. He is also the executive director of the Center for a Secure, Free Society. And we're always delighted to have him as a guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Joseph, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
I think I want to start in what is very much a target-rich environment at the moment, Joseph, with you on your take on what happened in Argentina recently with what appears to be the liquidation of a very courageous and quite determined prosecutor, Alberto Nisman. What do we know about what happened and who might have been responsible for this murder?
Yes, Frank. Unfortunately, the very tragic events in Argentina. For those that don't know, Dr. Alberto Nisman was a lead prosecutor in a very famous case on terrorism. The case against the AMIA Culture Center in 1994 that was bombed in Buenos Aires by Iranian and Hezbollah operatives. So Dr. Nisman has been involved in the case for about a decade. The lead prosecutor was investigating several angles and came up with an 800-page indictment on these Iranian individuals and one Lebanese individual as well that was already dead. But, you know, to no real avail. I mean, his main hurdle was that he couldn't get these Iranians to come face justice because there was no way that they were going to stand before a court. And I think in the most recent years, Nisman shifted his focus to look a little bit less on just trying to implicate the Iranians because he already had strong enough evidence to implicate them in the AMIA case and trying to find a way to actually force their hand to come before a court. And his most recent report that he released just a week before his death was actually a very interesting report.
Joseph Heumeier is our guest. He is an expert in matters of the hemisphere, author of Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America, and the executive director of the Center for a Secure, Free Society. And Joseph, I hate to interrupt you. We're just getting to the good part. But what was the idea that Alberto Nisman seems to have come up with to try to bring these Iranian perpetrators of this heinous crime in Argentina to justice?
Yeah, yes, Frank. What I was saying was essentially I think Nisman had discovered a method, a very creative method, to force Iran's hand so that they have to come before a court. And this last report, what I saw when I read it, it was very obvious, at least to me, that there was a strategic shift happening in the AMIA case. He was essentially taking what historically had been a terrorism case, you know, under the Argentine anti-terrorism laws, and was turning this into a criminal case against the Argentine government, particularly the Argentine president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and her foreign minister, Hector Timmerman, because he was going to accuse them of criminal conspiracy so that when this case can go before a court, perhaps an international court, he can, to some degree, extradite the Iranians through a form of subpoena. Because the big hurdle up until now was the way the Interpol Red Notice, the extradition order, works is that the Iranian government would have to arrest their own citizens and send them to custody so that they can be extradited to Argentina to stand trial for the terrorist bombing. We all know the Iranian government, Nisman knew the Iranian government was never going to do that.
In fact, the Iranian government was implicated in this attack, wasn't it?
Absolutely. These are powerful individuals. I mean, you know, you're talking about a former defense minister, two individuals that ran for president in the last Iranian election. I mean, there was no way that this was going to happen. Nisman knew this. So he had to find a way to force their hand. If he was able to bring the AMIA case, or more specifically, he was going to bring the criminal case against the Kirchners to an international court, then the extradition order would have worked more like a subpoena. It would have mandated that these Iranians appear before the court to testify on this case. Specifically, one Iranian named Moshe Rabbani, I think that was the one that he was specifically trying to go after. And I think that's what he was coming to in his last report. Unfortunately, you know, we never got to see him present it because he died the day before.
So what do we know about the circumstances under which he died, Joseph Heumeier? We were told initially that it was a suicide. That has now been widely discredited, as I understand it. But do you have a theory as to who was the perpetrator?
My theory is pretty obviously, I think, Iran or Hezbollah with some type of local or regional affiliate or co-conspirator. The evidence completely nullified the claim that this could have been a suicide. I mean, yeah, there was no suicide note. The murder weapon wasn't even his. He had no real motives or there was no pattern of behavior that could suggest a suicide.
No gunpowder on his hand. And apparently people had entry points into the apartment that that could have been used to both infiltrate and exfiltrate it. What about the possibility that the Argentinian government itself was implicated? Have you considered that?
Sure. I mean, it's the most obvious, I think, suspect since, you know, his last report was a criminal complaint against the Argentine government, the president herself. So obviously she has a motive. Obviously she could be a suspect. But if you look at the condition that exists in Argentina, I mean, her motives might be strong. They don't seem to be the strongest because she doesn't seem to stand the most benefit. First, let me just say that the Argentine president, you know, I don't, you know, trust in her. I mean, I definitely don't put this beneath her, but she has faced several criminal complaints throughout her presidency, accusations of money laundering, narco trafficking, embezzlement. She actually has a case pending here in the United States for corruption, public corruption. So this is not the first time that someone has actually taken a criminal case against her. I think, in essence, actually, the political environment that was in Argentina at the time, if this was a plot by her, was very poorly executed because this has caused a chaos throughout her entire presidency and has really rattled the cages around her closest allies.
Let's hope it'll bring her down. And, of course, let's hope it will also be an impediment to the further penetration that you've documented, Joseph Heumeier, in your book, Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. Let me turn quickly, in the remaining time we have with you, to Cuba. We're looking at the moment at the Obama administration pursuing aggressively a normalization of relations with the Cuban regime based on the performance of Roberta Jacobson there, the assistant secretary who led the normalization talks for the United States last week in Cuba. What do you make of the prospects for, well, first of all, full normalization and second of all, change of the kind the president claims he's interested in Cuba going forward?
The meeting by the Assistant Secretary Jacobson is a formality more than anything else. You know, obviously, it's somewhat historic in the eyes of the State Department. But in reality, I mean, the Cuban government's been, you know, kind of controlling the situation from the get-go, starting with all the concessions that were given to them in order to reach to this point, in order to get to this agreement. And what I'm afraid of is I think the Cuban government is manipulating the situation to get the most favor out of it while the U.S. is kind of losing its leverage or of any leverage it had perhaps over the Cuban regime, who controls a good part of the political environment in Latin America. Now, one of the things I think to look for is perhaps, you know, what's going to happen with our base and our detention facilities in Guantanamo. When I first heard the news about, you know, Obama's announcement in Cuba, you know, the first question that popped in my mind as a Latin American analyst was, why does Obama care about Cuba? I mean, he never really cared throughout his entire presidency about Latin America, never really made it a point to focus on the region, and now he's going to start with Cuba. It didn't make sense to me. But when I thought about it, one thing he did talk about throughout his entire presidency and made as a promise to his campaign was to shut down the detention facilities in Guantanamo and perhaps shut down the base as a whole. And what I came to find was the only thing that the president really needs from Cuba in order to shut down the Guantanamo base is the signature of their president. And perhaps that might be one of the things that he got through this concession.
Well, I'm reasonably sure that he will turn over that base as part of a more sweeping effort. And I would just argue that one of the other considerations for him is that this is an opportunity once again to enable and provide life support and otherwise embolden enemies of the United States. This seems to be kind of the consistent pattern of the Obama administration, I'm sorry to say. Joseph Heumeier, one other thing that I hope we'd have more time to talk about, but we'll have you on again soon to visit about, and that is the possibility that along with the transfer of Guantanamo Bay to Cuba, we might find enemies of this country taking up residence in that deep water port at the base, and that would be a strategic problem in the first order, I think. But Joseph, another time for that, and in the meantime, keep up the great work at the Center for a Secure, Free Society, and do come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz. We'll get his take on the president's pacifistic State of the Union address and China, what it's up to with its cyber espionage against this country.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The funeral this week for Saudi Arabia's late King Abdullah should be interesting. That's because the great game is on again, with the stakes, the future of the world's largest deposits of cheap and readily accessible oil. For two players in this game, Russia and Iran, the solution to their plunging economic fortunes is obvious. Reverse the Saudi-engineered oil glut and low prices. With Iranian-backed insurgents' takeover of neighboring Yemen, the Islamic State threatening another neighbor, Jordan, and perhaps Saudi Arabia itself, and Iran's incipient nuclear bomb, instability seems more likely in the kingdom than continuity. That may mean disruptions of supply, a change of policy, or even a change of government in Riyadh. One or the other becomes more certain if President Obama continues to be seen as feckless or worse, submissive to our enemies. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, the man we turn to each week for, well, a tour inside the ring. That's the title, of course, of his award-winning Washington Times column. He is also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon, one of the finest journalists covering the national security beat of our time, and always a welcome guest here. Bill, glad to have you back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
You wrote a rather critical piece about the president's State of the Union address as it related to his sort of view, not so much of the union, but of international affairs, foreign policy, and his security policies. Bill, talk a little bit about your take on all of that.
Right. During the State of the Union last week, the president outlined pretty much a heavy economic and domestic focus, and I did a piece that looked at his foreign and national security policies, which to me were, I described them at least in the headline, as pacifist and basically defeatist in a larger sense. This was really a look at why the United States is not taking aggressive action against terrorism, why it's not standing up to bullies like and aggressors like Vladimir Putin, and why he's pushing forward with an Iranian nuclear deal at all costs, which is the worst form of appeasement in modern times that I can think of.
Yeah. Well, pacifist, defeatist, appeasing. Another phrase that's been applied to it is delusional, Bill. The president seemed to be saying that all was well, kind of, at the same time as he was sort of laying out why we're not doing more. What's your read on that?
Well, it is kind of delusional. It made me think of the situation in Yemen, where we've had a Shiite coup against a pro-Western, working with us in counterterrorism regime there. It was just a short time ago that the president used Yemen as a showcase for his policies, and now we're seeing failures across the globe because of these policies. And these policies are based around the idea that the problem is America, and that America is too strong, that America is too assertive in the world, and it's a disaster. It's very similar to what we saw happen during the administration of President Jimmy Carter, where we had weak policies and this false liberal notion that if somehow we're nice to foreign powers, that they'll be nice back to us. And that's just a total misreading of the world situation, and we're seeing it much worse now under the Obama administration.
Yeah, it's Carter on steroids, really, and it's not just misreading of current events, it's a misreading, of course, of history. Bill, one of the places where that misreading is really bearing very poisonous fruit is in Ukraine at the moment. You've written about it. There have been developments over the weekend. This seems to really be a deteriorating situation in terms of Russian confidence that they can get away with doing whatever they wish in eastern Ukraine. Is that your read?
Yes, I did a piece in my Inside the Ring column that was based on a dispatch from Phil Carber, the Georgetown professor who is on a fact-finding mission to Ukraine, and he said the situation is dire. The Russians are moving in aggressively in the eastern part of Ukraine. The rebels are making advances on Mariupol, which is the key Black Sea port there, and he was saying what's really urgently needed is U.S. lethal assistance, which the Obama administration continues to refuse to supply to the Ukrainian military. In particular, he said they need Javelin anti-tank missiles and other types of anti-tank weaponry that can break through these Russian tanks that are being brought into the country in the eastern part, and also supplying the rebels, especially in the Donetsk region.
And Bill, there's no question now, according to Phil Carber and your reporting, that these are Russian units that are operating there. It's not they're going through the motions of having rebels operating equipment that they've managed to secret into this place.
Absolutely. And on top of that, the Russians have waged a very effective information warfare campaign that is convincing people or creating doubts in the elites throughout Europe that somehow this isn't really a fully Russian operation to basically split up this key country that wants to be a friend with the West and with NATO. It's really a challenge for NATO.
They're doing it certainly piecemeal, if not in whole. It is definitely a divide and conquer kind of approach. Bill, let me switch to another place where we've seen a real setback, and that is with respect to Chinese cyber espionage against key defense contractors and Pentagon secrets. A sort of showcase for this is the F-35 stealth fighter, the widely expected to be the mainstay of the United States military. Three services are using it in the future. Talk about what the Chinese have gotten and what its implications are.
Sure. I was reminded last night during the Pro Bowl game, they had the first public flyover of the F-35. And all I could think about was how China had pillaged our defense secrets that went into this frontline stealth fighter, this sixth generation fighter. Under documents released by Snowden and published in Der Spiegel, we got the first look at the actual levels of detail that the Chinese were able to obtain through cyber espionage, important critical details on the F-35. Specifically, they were able to understand its new phased array radar. This is a high-tech radar system that is used to be able to maintain its low visibility to foreign radar. Additionally, they were also able to get extremely valuable information on the jet engines used by the F-35, and specifically how those engines are able to mask the heat signatures, which is another critical feature for stealth jets. So they've basically been able to steal this technology, not only that, but to apply it in some of their own aircraft, including the J-20.
And what this has translated into, Bill Gertz, as you've made clear in your reporting at the Washington Times and over the months in the Washington Free Beacon, is that you have, in fact, both allowed the Chinese to, well, to use the expression Mao would have used, a great leap forward in terms of their own capabilities, as you say, the J-20 and perhaps other stealth fighters, but also to understand what may be vulnerabilities of the F-35 that they can exploit at will to the detriment, again, of this country should we wind up having to come to blows with them. Bill, one other place where you've been reporting, we're going to talk more about it with our next guest, Gordon Chang, but I would like to get your views on what's happening on the Korean Peninsula, especially in connection with a war game that is currently underway, as I understand it, at Special Operations Command involving General Scaparotti, the top American commander on the peninsula. What's going on?
Yeah, the General Scaparotti is in Tampa at the SOCOM War Game Center, and they're beginning to look at scenarios for a possible Korean conflict. It's kind of an eye-opener. It's a high-level strategy seminar. That's what the Pentagon's billing it. And among the scenarios they're looking at is how to stop North Korea's new road mobile ICBM, dubbed the KN-08, as well as North Korean cyber attacks and other new capabilities. So this is a sign that this could be part of the president's promised retaliation against North Korea for its hacking of Sony Pictures Entertainment last November.
Or it may simply be contending with a growing threat. And as you've pointed out, Bill, I think, in fact, you broke the story that KN-08 is now road mobile because of Chinese launchers that were provided against UN sanctions and certainly against our interests. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. This was a Chinese-built launcher that was the Chinese said that they exported it for lumber. It was a total deception. No one has sanctioned the Chinese for it, as they have not sanctioned China going back to the 80s when they helped Pakistan develop its nuclear program. It highlights the threat of Chinese nuclear proliferation. And in this case, it's a very real threat to the United States.
It is indeed. Bill, we've got less than a minute left. Very quickly, your appreciation of Chuck Hagel's tenure as Secretary of Defense.
Well, you know, I mean, he came in as the global zero defense secretary, and I think it's been characterized by someone that really was not well suited for the job. This was a person that really, I think, set back U.S. efforts to try and rebuild defenses, which are so urgently needed, facing severe budget cuts as well as the need to recapitalize the force.
Yeah, it may not have been a global zero, but it certainly was a giant zero. He's now going out, I gather, in his swan song exit interviews with people complaining about the condition of the United States military. He didn't do much to fix it. Bill, you do much to try to at least make sure we understand what the stakes are for our military and our country more generally with your terrific column Inside the Ring at the Washington Times and, of course, the work you do at the Washington Free Beacon. Keep it up and come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock with him of some of those developments on the Korean Peninsula and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Something unusual occurred in the aftermath of President Obama's State of the Union address when Washington Post columnist Glenn Kessler cited research from the Center for Security Policy in his Fact Checker column to fault the truthfulness of the president's statements about his efforts to halt the threat from Iran's nuclear program. Kessler cited a chart prepared by the center showing that Iran's enrichment of uranium has surged since 2009 and that Iran can now make at least 8 nuclear weapons from its enriched uranium stockpile. It is unheard of for the mainstream media to cite conservatives on arms control issues. The Post's decision to cite the Center's research reflects both the high quality of our work as well as growing concerns about the president's Iran policy. You can read our report issued last November, Why Congress Must Repudiate the Nuclear Talks with Iran, on the SecureFreedom.org website. I'm Fred Fleitz.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia and that of, well, so many others, Fox News, Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com. Gordon, of two important books, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He is a man we visit with each week here for an assessment of what's happening in Asia and what it might mean for us. Always welcome. Good to have you, Gordon.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Well, the president is in India as we speak and being feted, a lot of security, but the strategic implications of this visit are what I know matters most. Talk about those, if you would.
This is President Obama's second trip to India. This trip is rich in symbolism. This is the first time a sitting American leader has gone to India twice, And it is also the first time that the Indians have invited an American president to their Republic Day ceremonies. And had it not been for the death of King Abdullah and President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia at the tail end of this India trip, this would have been the first time in recent memory that an American leader has made a long-distance solo trip to just one destination. They're not going to be very much in the way of agreements. There is some talk of progress on the nuclear deal. But nonetheless, this is important because this is the world's most powerful democracy and its most populous one getting together.
The nuclear deal of which you speak is, of course, one involving civilian nuclear power reactors being sold from the United States to India. Is that right?
That's right. There's been the issue of liability. This is the hangover from President Bush's agreement with India, which I think is his most positive foreign policy legacy. Generations will remember what President Bush started and what President Obama has continued. Right now, what we're seeing is that an aggressive China is pushing both Washington and New Delhi closer together. And this is one of the most positive developments in the world.
And to the extent that those relationships that have been built, those openings, if you will, have been established, where do you expect this to go, Gordon, in terms of the relationship? Commercial reactors perhaps being one piece of it, trade, I'm certain, being another piece of it. But what else is likely to emerge, particularly of a strategic character, vis-a-vis, as you say, the increasing aggressiveness of China?
The most important thing here is that New Delhi is getting closer to American allies such as Japan, and also it is establishing a firm friendship with Vietnam, which Washington is also courting. So what we're having is really a knitting together of like-minded states around the periphery of China as all of these countries react to increasing belligerence from Beijing. And that is the most important strategic narrative here. We are going to see close cooperation, maybe not alliances, but at least close cooperation among New Delhi, Hanoi, Manila, South Korea, Japan, the United States. This is all going to be working together as countries realize they've got common interests.
We will be watching it closely, as will you. Gordon Chang is our guest. He is a columnist for Forbes.com. He blogs at WorldAffairsJournal.com. And, of course, you see him frequently at Fox News. And, Gordon, the other piece of this that I wanted to cover with you, we touched on in our conversation a moment ago with Bill Gertz, is North Korea and its activities at the moment. War games are apparently being, you know, conducted at the planning stage at Special Operations Command as we speak for dealing with an increasingly capable and aggressive North Korea. You've written recently about what the North Koreans are up to and also their changing relationship with their chief historic sponsor, namely Communist China. What's up with all that?
Chinese-North Korean relations are at a low point right now. Part of it is because Jun Song-taek, who is the leader's uncle, was executed in December 2013. And Jun Song-taek was really the primary link between China and North Korea. And with him gone and with the elimination of his patronage network, with all of these executions that we've seen recently, it really means that North Korea deliberately cut ties to the Chinese. While this is happening, though, we're seeing Moscow and Pyongyang get very much closer together. And people have said that Kim Jong-un has accepted Vladimir Putin's invitation to go to Moscow in May to celebrate the 70th anniversary of Russia's victory over Nazi Germany. And if that is indeed the case, that if Kim does indeed travel to Moscow, we could see a scrambling of relations. This is occurring while all sorts of things are happening from the diplomacy-wise on the Korean Peninsula. It's going to be a very different place a year from now.
Talk about the Russian angle as well, Gordon. The North Koreans presumably have not only a certain strategic value to the Russians as they are positioning in the region, but also this play with respect to a pipeline for their natural gas to South Korea. How important is that, and is that already something that's been nailed down, or do you anticipate that's a coming attraction?
Yeah, this is a coming attraction. Russia wants to sell natural gas to the South Koreans, and the only practical way to do that is through a pipeline. to get to South Korea, you have to have the pipeline travel through North Korea. So obviously Moscow needs Pyongyang's cooperation. This is important because Western European customers are starting to turn away from the Russians because of the sanctions over Ukraine, where events are getting much worse as we speak. And so Russia needs to diversify away from Europe, and the way to do that is Asia. He's selling more, of course, to the Chinese, but he, of course, would like an additional customer in the South Koreans, who probably will be one of his best customers in the years ahead if he can, in fact, arrange this pipeline.
It'll be fascinating to see, and particularly the dynamic between North Korea and China, as the two presumably depend upon each other, or at least the North Koreans depend heavily on the Chinese, even as this obvious strain is taking place in their relationship. You will be following it closely, Gordon, as I can assure you will we, and we look forward to talking with you about it early and often. Let me talk about something else that we discussed as it was unfolding, Gordon, on our last visit, Sri Lanka. And tell us more about how Sri Lanka fits into a larger Chinese aspiration for the Indian Ocean.
Beijing would like to dominate the Indian Ocean. They have what's called the Maritime Silk Road, which would connect ports on China to basically Africa, the Middle East, and of course then Europe. To do that, they've got to go through India's backyard. And to do that, they've been establishing relations with countries like Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, the Maldives. And they poured a lot of money into Sri Lanka. They've tried to affect politics there. But recently, the Sri Lankans turned out the pro-Beijing government, and now the country is up for grabs. The new government, of course, has to maintain relations with China, but nonetheless, it is trying to balance its ties by having a closer relations with New Delhi. This is going to be important because Sri Lanka is only 40 miles off of India's coast.
And to the extent that the Chinese were unable to essentially assure the future tenure of a pro-Chinese puppet, maybe too strong a word, but certainly someone aligned with the Chinese in Sri Lanka, do you think that that is likely to mean an ebbing of China's influence, not just in that country, but elsewhere in the region as well?
Well, clearly, China will lose influence in Sri Lanka in the years ahead. Beijing will work very hard to regain what it's lost. But what we have seen, though, in recent months is really a number of setbacks for China, especially with the November 29 elections in Taiwan. Clearly, the Burmese regime is moving much closer to the West. This is a part of a general trend that we're seeing on the periphery of China. Beijing is going to be working overtime to try to reverse recent losses. But right now, they seem to be having difficult time in Beijing keeping their friends.
Well, I feel their pain. It seems as though we're having some difficulty supporting ours, which may translate into having fewer of them as well. But we certainly are watching the Obama administration embrace a lot of enemies. This is what makes this business so interesting, as does having the chance to visit with you about it from time to time. Gordon, thank you very much for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.